It's 12 o'clock. This is KZSU Stanford.
Of course, this whole program is dedicated to the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know that. Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow men. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to Earth stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead. Oh yeah. Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country fall, stand or fall? Is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain? He'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better cause we're headed for the brink. What will happen now that he is dead? He was for equality for all people, you and me. Love and goodwill, hate was not his way. He was not a violent man. Tell me, folks, if you can, just why was he shot down the other day? He'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead.
Welcome to a special edition of Shedding Light here on KZSU. And today, it's actually the last edition of the lunch special. The last edition I'll be doing. The lunch special might live on beyond me. But this six-year run of this show, with me as the host, is over as of today. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in. And right now, on the phone with us from Northern California, Derek Jensen. Derek, welcome back to KZSU.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Derek, you are an author, a radical activist, an environmentalist, a lecturer, a philosopher, once a beekeeper, an educator. And they've been playing a lot of Martin Luther King on the radio today. Democracy Now! Had some great stuff from him. And he was a prophet. He did prophesize that if we didn't get off the path we were on, if we didn't stop being the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet, the United States would basically go down in flames. That's what he said a year to the day before he got killed. And in reading your material in the last couple of months, I consider what you write about a kind of a prophecy. And I don't want to heap that big name on you, but I think you are prophesizing. And I want to read a quote out of a book you had a piece to do in. You wrote the preface, and then you wrote some responses to questions. It's called Deep Green Resistance by Eric McBay and Larry Keith. And you do the preface, like I said. And in Deep Green Resistance, you wrote, quoting Derek Jensen now, "My definition of dismantling civilization is depriving the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and depriving the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. Nobody but a capitalist or a sociopath, insofar as there is a difference, could disagree with that." Why don't we use that as a jumping off point? And let's cut right to the chase now, because Deep Green Resistance has to do with dismantling modern industrial civilization. Can you speak about that?
Sure. Anybody who's paying any attention whatsoever, or anybody with a conscience, recognizes that this culture is killing the planet. In the last 25 years, about 1 million species have gone extinct. There are about 200 species go extinct per day. This culture has been a disaster for other cultures. I mean, this culture commits genocide against every indigenous culture. There used to be thousands or tens of thousands of different cultures all over the planet living sustainably. Where I live in far northern California, the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe science, or since the beginning of time, if you believe the Talawa. And they did so sustainably. The place was a paradise when the first members of the dominant culture arrived here, and the place is trash now. And another way to look at this is that, they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. Well, I'm going to lay out a pattern here, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And that's, when you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of, cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's what it was before the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to make cities. And then the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. The big three Greek writers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all complained that deforestation was harming water quality. North Africa was heavily forested. Those forests went down to build the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. That's what this culture does, is eat land bases. Another way to look at this is that the only ways of living that are sustainable are those that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. It's a big blowout. And any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last, such that if there are fewer salmon return every year, there will eventually be none. And this way of life is based on drawdown, and that won't last. And what is going to happen after after this blowout, what's going to be left? I mean, there's not going to be much left. And so we see the trends. I mean, every biological indicator, every major biological indicator is heading the wrong direction. And so once we step past the denial, it's like, okay, so what do we do? And it's pretty clear that that what we need to do is to stop the destructive activities. It's like one of the jokes I tell at my talks is, you know, if you ask any reasonably intelligent 7 or 8 year old, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, the reasonably intelligent 7 or 8 year old will answer you, you stop burning oil and gas. And if you ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for some sort of so-called green high-tech consulting firm how to stop global warming causing great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they'll give you some answer that helps a green high-tech consulting firm. So this culture is based on exploitation. I mean, it's where the reason that the non-industrialized nations are impoverished is not because they're not industrialized. The reason that they're impoverished is because all our wealth is based on their impoverishment. It's based on land theft, and it's based on colonies. It's based on theft of resources.
Derek Jensen is our guest. If you just tuned in, Derek Jensen is our guest. He's a radical activist, author, and much, much more. He lectures. Check his website at derekjensen.com. He might be coming to a city near you.
.org.
And you can catch him on anywhere on the internet, just under his own name, Derek Jensen. And Derek, in Deep Green Resistance, you guys really laid out, the two main authors really laid out a blueprint for how people can bring this dominant culture, this industrial civilization, to a halt. And part of their example was they used Nigeria. Now, the people in Nigeria just called off their strike today. We heard that in the news. For the last 7 days, they shut down the entire country, and that was over the government raising the price of fuel, doubling it overnight. And the people showed, and that was lawyers, doctors. It wasn't just the poor. It was across the whole board. They shut the entire country down. In Deep Green Resistance, you guys have given kind of a blueprint on how to do that. Can we discuss that?
Sure. It's one of the central things, for lack of a better word, one of the central parts of social change that we too often forget in our privileged position in the United States is that social change happens through power. It doesn't happen because you beg those in power to do the right thing. And power can come in many forms. Another way to say this is that those in power really only understand force, which doesn't have to mean violence. It can, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah, just get into that a little bit, because I think people get real puzzled, you know, when they hear force. They write it off like, oh, you want to be violent.
Well, one way to think about this is are the bus boycotts that are so famous. They didn't succeed because the owners of the bus companies suddenly became non-racist, and they didn't succeed because there was this epiphany on the part of the owners. Instead, they succeeded because the entire African-American community was able to economically bring the bus companies to their financial knees.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem with a lot of environmentalists and a lot of environmental thinking. I say this as a long-term grassroots activist, that so often our activism basically consists of begging, you know, begging the capitalist in chief to act against the interests of capital, which may happen once in a while, but that's not really a political plan with a future. It's not a political plan with a present, frankly.
So what should we do?
Well, there are a bunch of, well, the first thing we should do is we should look at, we should educate ourselves, and we should look at what, well, actually the first thing we should do is we should figure out what we want. And that's another problem with a lot of environmentalists, is we don't really know what we want. Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts? You know, what do we want? Because you can't figure out, I mean, people ask, for example, how we can stop global warming. But when they ask how we can stop global warming, they're really not asking how we can stop global warming. They're asking how can we stop global warming without stopping industrial culture. Mm-hmm. And the answer is you can't. Or how can we stop, they say they want to protect salmon, and that's all great, that's a wonderful thing. But when they say how can we save salmon, they're not saying how can we save salmon. What they're really asking is how can we save salmon without taking out dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the oceans, without stopping industrial agriculture, and so on. And the answer is you can't. But so the first thing we need to ask is, what do we want? And I mean, I'm very clear on what I want. I want to live in a world that has amphibians, and I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and I want to live in a world that has living oceans, and I want to live in a world that has less dioxin than every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And so how do we go about that?
Mm-hmm.
And now let's jump back to this question of force.
How is force not violence?
Well, it doesn't have to be, because...
Yeah, that was a great example of the bus boycott, for sure.
And then there's also the French shut down the entire French economy because it's 2012, but a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
They shut it down through massive strikes, and not through just sort of going to have a strike at random places, but instead thinking strategically. What the economy needs to continue is oil. That's what it runs on. And so what they did is they blockaded oil terminals. They blockaded refineries. And by thinking strategically, by looking for leverage points, by looking for, another way to put this, choke points, bottlenecks, they were able to leverage their efforts to actually shut down the economy. And they did this nonviolently. And if you've got the numbers, this force can be entirely nonviolent. And Gene Sharp has written extensively about this. And on the other hand, if you don't have the numbers, then still, once again, you want to achieve some objective, then that's where violence has been used as a tool for social change. And a great example of that is that one person all by himself almost stopped World War II. That's George Elser. And nobody knows who he is. He's a trade unionist who was horrified by what Hitler was doing. And so he got a job in a mine so he could steal some explosives. And he was a watchmaker by trade, I believe.
Was he American or German?
Oh, he's German. He's German. And he then built a bomb, but with a timer that would go off during one of Hitler's speeches in 1939. And unfortunately for the world, he set it to go off like I don't remember what time, 8:20 or something. And Hitler's speech normally went from 7:30 to 8:30. But because of weather considerations, Hitler had to change the time of his speech, so he spoke from 7 to 8.
Oh, man.
Bomb went off 20 minutes later, killed a bunch of Nazis. And the point is that, this is 1939, everybody who talks about resistance to Hitler says that had Hitler died in 1939, there would not have been World War II. And so one person all by himself, in that case, and I don't think anybody can argue against assassinating Hitler. I mean, if somebody's going to argue against that, then there's really no starting point for a conversation. But the point, and I want to say one thing very clearly, I am not by this suggesting that assassination would be an appropriate tool in the United States. You know, only the president actually suggests that.
I agree 100%. And being on KZSU Stanford, I have to say that, too, that we don't advocate any kind of violence like that.
Well, that's fine, and I'm not saying this wink, wink. Actually, the whole social circumstances are different.
Right.
But it was a stark example of one person leveraging power. But he didn't. If they would have had, you know, 10 million people, then they could have done this through strikes.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point. Is that there's a continuum of forms of force. It's like, in many ways, the best environmental president there's been in the last 50 years was Richard Nixon.
People say
and
that.
It's not because he was particularly environmental. It's because he was terrified. And the reason he was terrified is because of the anti-war protests and because of Watergate. And so he started throwing out Clean Water Act, NEPA, NIFMA, Endangered Species Act, all these.
He created the EPA, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh, which, by the way, I just have to say this, and this is apropos of nothing. You didn't ask me about this. I'm sort of wondering. But can you believe John Huntsman, 2 or 3 days ago, he said that they needed to end the EPA's, quote, reign of terror. He was actually calling the EPA a terrorist organization.
Yeah, he was.
And it's pretty...
Is that shocking to you?
No, it's just pretty extraordinary that the devaluation of the word terrorism, and it's very Orwellian in that, you know, using drones to bomb entire populations is called preserving the national interest, and regulating industry is called terrorism.
Let me quote you real quick from Deep Green Resistance one more time. Derek Jensen wrote, since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. We can provide for this for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after energy and ecological descent by preparing people for a localized future. We can rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. We can go teach people how to identify local edible plants so the people won't starve when they can no longer go off to the grocery store. And we can start setting up neighborhood councils to make decisions, settle conflicts, and provide mutual aid. I thought that that paragraph right there struck me like a lightning bolt. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Sure. That paragraph really originated from an attack that's been made against my work, or a critique that's been made against my work for a long time, which I've never thought was very fair, which is that by talking about the fact that industrial civilization is killing the planet, and we need, for the planet's sake, and for the sake of impoverished people around the world, we need to bring it down as soon as possible. One of the responses people have said is they've said that means I want to commit genocide. That means I want to kill lots of people because a lot of people are dependent upon industrial civilization for their lives. And the reason that critique has bothered me is because it ignores the genocide on which this culture is based. And it's like, And so I have a bunch of responses I would like to go through very, very quickly to that. And
please do.
When people say, you know, a lot of people are going to die through the crash of civilization, my first response is, well, a lot of people are dying right now. And for one thing, there's the hammerhead shark people, and there's the delta smelt people, and there's the chimpanzee people, and the orangutan people. But they don't count in this human supremacist culture. But then there's more. There's also subsistence farmers in India who are being driven off their land. There's a huge land grab going on, a massive land grab going on all across Asia, all across the colonies now. But evidently those people don't count either. There's tremendous resistance to this land theft by the capitalists all over the world, because these are people who are being driven off their land. They're fighting against the Belamonte Dam right now in South America.
Oh, really?
Which is, I'm sorry?
No, I just wondered where it was.
It's on the Dinko River. There are the Yoruna people, and there are some other peoples too, and they're being driven off their land for industrialization. But somehow the people who say that, you know, a lot of people are going to die, they ignore the people who are systematically being killed right now to support this way of life. And that's fine, but still, when civilization crashes, a lot of people are going to die. And another part of the answer is that, I'll go ahead and cut to the chase since we only have an hour, but if your primary concern really is for the well-being of the humans who will be alive through the crash, then what you need to do is, instead of complaining about me stating the obvious, which is that this culture is not sustainable, what you need to do is to start preparing people for the crash. And there are people, you know, Transition Town people are doing some of that. And there's a lot of relocalizing work that's really, really important to do. But the important thing here is we need to combine this relocalization work, and every resistance movement ever, every successful resistance movement has done this, that you need to combine this relocalization work where you, Kropotkin said that a lot of revolutions founder because of bread. And what he means by that is you can have this great, glorious revolutionary idea, and you can have this great, glorious revolution happening, but if the people can't eat, you're not going to succeed. So you need to be able to detach yourself from the dominant culture as much as possible in that sense. And then the problem is that a lot of withdrawals sort of stop there. But you need to do that at the same time that you're working to dismantle the oppressive structures themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American patriots did this, that at the same time, we all heard of, you know, the Stamp Act, the Tea Party. We've all heard of all those things. You know, the U.S. patriots were a bunch of rich white slave owners, males. But that doesn't alter the fact that in some senses they ran a successful resistance movement. And one of the things that they did is they set up these alternative court systems. They set up the alternative food systems. They set up all sorts of systems so they would not be dependent upon the British. And they didn't do this so that they could be pure. And they didn't do this because they thought that this was sufficient. They did this so that they would not be dependent upon their enemy. And then they did the next step, which is to attempt to destroy the enemy's capacity to wage war on them.
So they set
the
up
Irish
an alternative
did the same thing.
So they set up an alternative system first, and then went about not only turning their back on the old system, but getting rid of it, getting it out of its hair.
Exactly. Except I wouldn't necessarily say it's first. I would say they're somewhat simultaneous.
Mm-hmm. Is there an example of that going on today?
Well, there are all the transition town movements, and there's all the permaculture movements, and there's all sorts of pretty great localization going on. And that's all great, and I want to really say good things about them. And the hesitation is that a lot of, not all, but many of the people associated with those actively discourage the notion of resistance. And I really want to attempt to reawaken in a lot of those people the understanding that, I mean, they know that the system is rotten and they know the system's going down, and that's all, that's really important. And then I want to reawaken in them the understanding that resistance can be successful and that resistance is necessary. But that's the thing, is we can all make our little transition towns, and that's all fine. And that's important work to do, but we have to recognize, it's like, I've done some talks, I did a talk years and years ago at Bioneers, and it broke my heart. And the reason it broke my heart is because people there are talking about all these ways they can try to transition away from the dominant culture, but I was the only person there that I know of who was talking about either power or psychopathology. And I don't know how you can talk about social change without talking about power. And I don't know how you can talk about the dominant culture that's killing the planet without talking about sociopathology. And my point with this is, you know, what has this culture done, and what does this culture continue to do to any sustainable cultures? Years and years ago, gosh, this was like 15 years ago now, 18 years ago, I was at this sort of conference thing where there was maybe 30 of us who were doing this sort of brainstorming thing. And one of the exercises we were supposed to do was, it was a whole bunch of people talking about sustainable agriculture, which is an oxymoron. But anyway, one of the exercises we're supposed to do is this person said, okay, imagine that it's 25 years from now, and we've achieved some sort of transition to sustainability, and so I want you to talk about what it smells like and what it feels like and what it looks like and what your community looks like, and do you ride bicycles, blah, blah, blah. And everybody went around giving their answers, and that was breaking my heart, too, because two reasons. One is because bicycles are made of metal. And I mean, that's the example the guy threw out is people riding bicycles. And bicycles are less unsustainable than cars, but bicycles are made of metal. And if you use things that are made of metal, it means you've got to have mining, which means you have to have an industrial infrastructure. And they just don't think this through. And you can't pick and choose. If you have a city, it's going to be unsustainable because you've got to have the resources come from somewhere. If you have bicycles, if you have watches, if you have an electrical system, you've got to have mining and everything that comes with that, which is the unsustainability that comes with that.
You know,
so that was the first thing. But the second thing is like the person skipped over how this happened. I mean, did it happen because a bunch of unicorns started burping pixie dust and jumped over the moon? I mean, how did this transition, how do we stop them? And that's the thing that so many people ignore, is that let's pretend, and this is what I said at the group. I said, okay, you know, we have this exercise we're doing, and if we have this community that's all sustainable, and those in power all of a sudden realize that there are tar sands under our little sustainable community, what are they going to do?
Come
if
and get
uranium
it.
Uranium under our sustainable community, what are they going to do? If they want the resource, there's trees on our community, and they want those trees, what are they going to do? What they're going to do is they're going to come in, they're going to take them, and they're going to kill us. I think that's the first step we have to understand about fighting back against this culture, is that those in power are sociopaths, and they'll do whatever is necessary. They'll kill whomever and whatever they have to in order to increase their power. That's the first thing we have to understand about fighting back.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Derek Jensen, a radical activist, author of over 20 books, lecturer. You can catch him on the web at derekjensen.org, and there's a lot there, a lot of videos. Derek, this is amazing talk. I don't think there's enough of this in print or in the media today. I feel the same way you do, and yet it's so hard to hear this kind of talk anywhere.
I think that's partly because we're in the United States, and we in the United States are the primary beneficiaries of this.
Yeah.
Of this exploitation.
Right, bunch of spoiled children.
There's a great line by Upton Sinclair I think about all the time. It's hard to make a man understand something. Excuse the sexism. It's his, not mine. It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would say it's hard to make people understand something when their laptop computers depend on them not understanding it, or when they're there's a great line by this this pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s talking about why they can't end slavery, which is, he said, where would we get the comforts or elegancies to which we've all become accustomed?
Yeah,
and you get a lot of people. It's like after Fukushima, one of the Japanese energy ministers said that, of course, we have to continue with nuclear because we can't imagine living without electricity. And that's an extraordinary statement because right now around the world, the majority of human beings are living without electricity, and the majority of human beings have lived up until, you know, what, the 1890s or something, all humans live without industrially generated electricity. We did very fine, frankly.
Yeah.
And the people who say we can't imagine living without electricity are the ones who are addicted to it. And what about the people who live in where the Belamonte Dam is going to, and then, by the way, they're still putting in new dams. Even in the United States, they're still planning. In Washington State, they're planning on putting in a bunch of new dams. It's really terrible.
The Belamonte you're talking about, I think, is the one in the not just the Amazon jungle. It's in Brazil, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're displacing indigenous tribes. They're just pushing them out of the way and going, no, you're not going to be in this valley because we're going to flood it, even though you've lived here for some thousands of years, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also the they're planning on putting in 11 new dams on the Mekong.
In Vietnam?
Which will displace hundreds of thousands of human beings who live there and will probably extirpate the Mekong catfish, which is the largest freshwater fish in the world. And, you know, of course, it'll just destroy lots of other things. That's still happening, and that's all for electricity to feed China.
Mm-hmm.
No, sorry, to feed. That's really terrible language on my part. To fuel China's industrialism.
Mm-hmm. You recently did a seminar with quite a few heavyweight guests at UC Berkeley, and one of them was Erin Dottie Roy. And I got a chance. I wasn't there that day, but I got a chance to hear her speech that day. And she talked about, in the writing of her last book, it took her to the center of India, where there are indigenous people. It's a virtual wilderness, has been, and the government has sent in government troops to displace these people so industry can come in there and start carving out. Basically, India is being hollowed out in the center for industry. Can you speak a little bit about that? Because that's a stark example of how this system is really brutalizing people.
Well, we don't have to go to India. We can talk about the Appalachians, where they're doing mountaintop removal.
Yeah, good idea. That's right. Right here in the States.
But one difference is that in India there are
resistance groups.
A lot of India is in open armed revolt.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the names of the other groups, but there's many, many separatist groups who are
fighting back.
Who are fighting against this land theft. And one of the things that Erin Dottie brought up is a question she has for the Naxalites, are one of the largest groups. And one of the questions she asked for them is, can you say you're able to create these autonomous zones, can you leave the bauxite in the mountains and can you leave the water in the rivers? Or are you going to follow this industrialism as well? And that's a huge question, a huge and important question for them. But there are a lot of people around the world who are actively resisting the theft of their resources. And so that's another of the excuses that we hear a lot in the United States is that resistance can't work, and that's not. You mentioned Nigeria a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
The movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta has been able to reduce oil output in the Niger Delta by up to 80%, and routinely by up to 30%, and that's through targeted attacks on refineries.
And that's amazing because in Nigeria they kill you. They'll hang you. They'll kill you. It's no due process, or they're going to put you on trial. They will just shoot you dead when you go out on the front lines. I was going to mention earlier in France. I don't think the government forces, the police and the army, do they brutalize their people as much as folks either in the United States or say in Nigeria? You know, I think one of the reasons that might have worked in France is they didn't get brutalized as bad as, say...
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't either. But when... it's amazing that Nigeria worked, but it took the whole country to get on board with it, for sure. What do you see as a... Do you see this happening in your lifetime? Something along the lines of what you're talking about slowing down or shutting down dominant culture. Is this possible?
Well, I don't see this current economic system lasting through my lifetime. But honestly, I don't see it coming down primarily because of resistance. I see it primarily coming down because of the single-minded greed and stupidity of those in power. And one of another joke I've told that isn't very funny is that I think Bernie Madoff was one of the best environmentalists because he helped collapse the economy in 2008. And in 2009 was the lowest rate of deforestation in the Amazon since they started keeping records because of the collapse of the global economy.
Really?
And
does that give you any ideas? I mean, if Bernie Madoff, you know, he wasn't aiming to do that, but through his greed, he actually helped slow it down. Does that conjure up any kind of ideas about how to slow it down?
Well, I don't have access to the same sorts of tools that he did.
That's true.
But what it suggests to me is a really obvious point that the way, and also carbon emissions went down. I mean, they didn't go down, but they didn't accelerate as much as they normally do. And that was because of the slowdown of the economy. And it makes a pretty obvious connection that most environmentalists miss, which is that it's the economy that is the fuel for this. I mean, what is gross national product, really?
What GNP is is
a numerical measure of how quickly the living are converted to the dead. Because that's what GNP is the conversion of living forests to 2x4s, because a living forest isn't worth money, and a 2x4 has been brought into that economic system. Years and years ago, I was talking to Ward Churchill, and I said, I don't understand how the Germans were so stupid to keep such great records, such clear and concise records of these atrocities they were committing. I mean, yeah, the atrocities, I've written extensively about the atrocities and the Holocaust. It's absolutely atrocious. And to top it off, they just kept these meticulous, nice, neat records. And he just looked at me and he said, Derek, what do you think GNP is? And GNP is a measure of how quickly the real world is converted into products. And so it seems pretty obvious to me that, I mean, the world can't withstand this economic system. And so will this end in my lifetime? I don't know how it's sputtering along as fast as it is, as long as it is. And that's actually an advantage I think we have. There's David Brower famously said that all of our environmental losses are permanent and our victories are always temporary. Because if you stop some atrocity, you know, they just come back and try it again in 5 years, and eventually you're going to lose. And that's been true for the longest time. But given the way the economy is faltering, I'm not sure that that's true anymore. I think it might be possible that any atrocity we can stop now, basically, I mean, we don't talk about this in public, but the environmental activists I know, basically all of us are just holding on by our fingernails, you know, hoping and praying and doing everything we can to make sure that some piece of ground survives. Because it's like an environmentalist friend of mine says that the reason he's doing his work is because he wants to make sure, because as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is if bull trout are still alive in 10 years, they may still be alive at 100. But if they're gone in 10, they're gone forever. So he and so many others are just desperately trying to keep trees standing or to keep some creature alive for 5 years, for 10 years, waiting for the economy to collapse. Because once it and actually in my neighborhood right here, we had an example of this, that there was this so-called developer, and I call him so-called because develop means to become something better or fuller. And like a caterpillar develops into a butterfly, a forest does not develop into white box houses. So this guy came in to try to destroy part of the forest here, and we in the neighborhood fought him off. And we did this all, you know, legally. You know, no matter how much I fantasized about anything else, we stopped him through filing a lawsuit and making sure he obeyed whatever laws there are. And the thing is, we were able to stop him, but we all knew we were going to have to stop him again in a year and a year and a year, you know, just keep stopping him. But this was 2007 and 2008, and the economy collapsed. And he has since left the community. The taxes have not been paid on this land, and the trees are still standing. And the point is, we didn't stop him. We just held him off long enough for the world, for the economy to stop him. And that's what so many activists I know are doing, just holding on for waiting for that collapse.
You think that's a good strategy?
I think it's a strategy, and then I think often, I mean, I've studied a lot of military history going back to when I was a kid, and I think often about the particular strategy that Robert E. Lee used at the Battle of Chancellorsville, which is a pretty typical strategy. It's called hammer and anvil, which is he kept half of his army in one place as the anvil, and then he sent Stonewall Jackson around to with the rest of the army to smash the Union army from the other side, and that was the hammer. And so I think that that's applicable to all sorts of that's a strategy that's applicable to all sorts of circumstances. Like we were talking about the transition town movement earlier, and that's the anvil. You need to have that solidity, and then at the same time you need to have the solidity in the defense, and then at the same time go on the offense, and that's the hammer. And so I think that that protecting pieces of ground is the hammer part, and then I think also we need to have the hammer where we go on the offensive to start working to dismantle going after pieces of infrastructure, going after refineries, shutting down refineries, shutting down transportation systems. And that's what we need to... I mean, that's what in Nigeria, as you just said, the reason they dropped that... Oh, I don't know if you know this, but the IMF was behind raising the fuel prices in Nigeria.
That I didn't know. The hidden hand.
Yeah, which they do everywhere. Anyway, so in that case, the reason... This is an example of what I'm talking about with force, is that the reason that the...
Nigerians succeeded?
The Nigerians have succeeded in putting that off for a while is because the government became terrified of them stopping... The government became terrified of the people taking to the streets. And
well, did the people...
not? Strength.
They did take to the streets, didn't they? Didn't the people take to the streets?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Demonstrations of 20,000 people.
Yeah, and it was countrywide. Davey D. from KPFA interviewed a local woman in Nigeria. She was a doctor, and she said it was across the board, lawyers. It was every strata of society, and they just all were fed up. They had enough, and they shut it down. And it was 7 days, and the government gave in and put the prices back where they were before the strike. That was a serious show of what people power can do. And like you said... that was basically nonviolent force. I don't think that many people got killed. Here in the United States, though, you and I both know, just from a devil's advocate standpoint, if we went to shut down an oil refinery, say we all met up in Richmond and we wanted to shut that down, the cops would show up, and if they couldn't arrest us, they would shoot us. We know this, right? That's not a reason not to do it, but the response here in the States...
Huh? That's the reason to do it, because...
Right.
It's, you know, when I spoke at the Occupies, I spoke at several of them, and one of the things I did at each one is, or most of them, was I talked about the police, and I made mention of the fact that the ones I did later especially, that I find it telling and significant that there have been police and members of the military in Libya and Egypt and Syria who have refused to attack Libyans and Egyptians and Syrians.
There were some county sheriffs in America that refused to go after the Occupy people, too.
They did for a while.
Yeah, it was
a
very
small... But the ones I know about only did that for a little while, and then they changed their mind.
Yeah.
Albany, New York, I know, did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point that I was making to the police is, do you want to explicitly be more repressive? Do you want to acknowledge that you are more repressive than members of the police and military in open military dictatorships? That's really not a very good legacy.
Yeah, but the cops have their job to do, and there's really no talking to them once they show up like that. You're aware, we both are.
Oh, I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, you're aware, we both are. Gene Kwan, the mayor of Oakland, let it slip that there was a mayor's conference call. Amy Goodman had it on Democracy Now, too. There was a mayor's conference call with a guy from Homeland Security, with at least 15 mayors on the phone at once. And Amy Goodman actually interviewed this guy from Homeland Security. He said, he kind of denied there was any kind of conspiracy at all. But and you've talked about this in your writing, that the other side, the 1% or the powers that be or whatever you want to call it, they are very well organized. And they know how to do systematic, very organizational things to shut down any kind of dissent at all. And again, I love the way you approach this, because you say that's all the more reason to get involved and do something.
It is, because the recognition that they are oppressive is, and why would we put up with? I mean, I ask people all over the country, do you believe we live in a democracy? And nobody ever says yes. They just laugh. I mean, I ask, so do you think the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? And it's a stupid question. I mean, everybody knows that the government takes better care of corporations. And I ask, I mean, a couple more jokes I tell that aren't very funny, which is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. And the second one is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. That's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal. Or another way to put this is, what do you call someone who tries to put cyanide or plans to put cyanide in the subways of Tokyo? And the answer is, you call them a terrorist and you put them in prison for the rest of their life. And another question is, what do you call someone who plans to poison the groundwater supply in the entire United States? And the answer is Dick Cheney. You call him an oil and gas person. You call him a fracker. There is no justice brought to, there is no accountability for those in power. There's no accountability whatsoever. And they can literally get by with murder. And, you know, years ago, I know we're starting to run down on time, but I think this is a good thing to sort of aim toward the end here.
Mm-hmm.
But years ago, I did a benefit at down in southern New Mexico for a group of people who were organizing to prevent a toxic waste dump in their community, which, of course, is a poor community of people of color. And a lot of the cops actually lived in their neighborhood, but then when they put, and they're fine when they're on their uniform on, when they put on their uniform, then they would act. They would arrest their neighbors who were protesting these toxins being put in their neighborhood that were going to poison their own children. And they would put on the uniform, and then they would become agents of, who were going to impose what rich people from a long ways away wanted to happen. And so we in the group started to fantasize, you know, what if cops actually did their jobs? What if cops were to enforce cancer-free zones? What if cops were to enforce big box free zones? What if cops were to enforce clear cut free zones or dioxin free zones or hell, what if they were to do rape free zones, you know? And then we all just laugh, because we know, of course, that the cops aren't going to do that. So then we said, okay, so what if we in our community decided we will have a cancer free zone? We in our community, it is important. We don't want our children to die of cancer. We're going to enforce a carcinogen-free zone, or we're going to enforce a rape-free zone, or we're going to enforce a clear-cut-free zone, a dam-free zone. You know, whatever it is we in our community want to keep out, we're going to enforce that. And then what if we meant it? And then, since the police aren't doing their jobs, what if we took that on as our jobs? And we started to form anti-cancer militias, and we started to form anti-clear-cut militias, and we started to form anti-rape militias, which, by the way, those anti-rape militias have happened. After the revolution in China, soon after Mao came to power, there were lots of women would go community to community. They would form gangs, and they would go community to community. If they saw a man beating on a woman, they'd beat him up. And if he did again, the consequences would be more severe. And there's right now in India, there's the Pink Sari Gang, the Gulabi Gang, which are groups of women who wear pink saris and train in the martial arts. And if they see a man abusing a woman, they'll beat him up. And if they see if they see cops abusing a poor person, they'll beat him up. And so what if we in our communities decided We will not allow distant corporations to destroy our community. And then we meant it. And we formed militias that were serious about keeping carcinogens out of our communities. Well, that looks a lot like revolution to me.
That's Derek Jensen, folks. You've been listening to him for the hour. This is my last edition of the lunch special. We'll see if it goes on after this. Derek, I want to thank you for your time, and I do want to do this again in the future for the web. Can we do that?
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay. Derek, keep up the great work. Folks can catch you at derekjensen.org, and they can see everything there. And you will be on the road. Check the website. Derek might be coming to a town near you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I got one more thing, too.
What?
www.deepgreenresistance.org.
Okay. Hit that up, too, folks. Thanks, Derek, and you take care.
Thanks so much. You, too.
All right.
Bye.
And thanks to everybody that tuned in to the lunch special for the last 6 years. I loved every minute of it.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. No. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Mercy means all things and what they used to be lost, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy means all things and what they used to be lost. Underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby us now. Oh, mercy, all things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand?